What happened the night Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez died?
There needs to be some rest. There needs to be some closure.
We follow the leads on Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Several weeks ago, when the VA Medical Center in Long Beach was launching its vaccination drive, my mother, who's been a longtime volunteer at the VA, was volunteering her efforts, making sure that not just patients, but veterans, family members, caregivers, people within the personal universes of veterans were getting their vaccinations. She described it as a pretty impressive operation to me. But of course, there are significant numbers of veterans like other people in the country who are not yet vaccinated. And joining us to talk about the efforts to boost the rate of vaccination is the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, Dennis McDonough. Secretary McDonough, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Larry, and thanks to your mom for volunteering at the VA.
Yeah, she loves being associated with it. Let's talk, first of all, about this challenge. What is the VA doing at this point to up the percentage of veterans, family members, and others in their orbit to get them vaccinated?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, Larry, is we're trying to make sure that every veteran, spouse of a veteran, caregiver for a veteran, child of a veteran understands that if they walk in at any of our clinics, they can get vaccinated. So that's the first thing is we're available. And if you haven't had access to the vaccine, we can get it to you free of charge. So please come in. Second is we're also contacting our vets whom we haven't been in touch with. So we're sending them letters, email, texts. We're making phone calls to make sure that they're aware of what's out there for them. And we're also then making sure that our clinicians, our doctors and our nurses who know our vets very well are on the phone with vets answering their questions if they have them about the vaccine. If there's some particular concern they have, we'll make sure that we answer those questions. And so those are some of the things that we're doing.
What about the effect of the pandemic on VA medical facilities? Because I know that, like other hospitals and medical centers, that a number of procedures were delayed so that you could treat people with COVID, and that they're, you know, now you're getting all that pent-up demand for surgeries, for procedures, things like that. So how are you dealing with that shift as we're coming out of the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so first of all, you are right that during the height of the pandemic, we had to close some of our medical facilities out of safety and out of concern for our vets. So some of the services that our vets had come to rely on were not available in a traditional way. Urgent care services, we maintained those. And in fact, we find that any urgent care issue that's raised by a vet is resolved in less than a day and a half. And obviously, our emergency department stayed open. But you are right that some of the other services we provided got shifted to video. As has often been the case over the years, the VA is a real leader in health innovation. We saw a nearly 10 times increase in the amount of video appointments we provided for our vets in all sorts of locations across the country. But nevertheless, now, today, veterans, just like the rest of the economy, where somewhere up to 40%, according to CDC, 40% of Americans forewent some kind of health care over the course of the pandemic, we're seeing that too with vets. And so sometimes they're coming in with enhanced complications, maybe some things that are a little bit more complex to address. And so we're seeing a significant uptake in VA healthcare right now, which is good because we're here for our vets, but it also just means that we're going to have to be very nimble in how we do it, and it might end up costing us a little bit more.
In recent years, veterans have had the opportunity to get care in community settings at non-VA facilities for people that live far away from VA medical centers or clinics. They've had that opportunity for others who might prefer to go use a non-VA facility, and their care still ends up being covered. One of the big concerns that people have about that is the costs associated, and also what that means for the VA's own facilities if they end up getting shortchanged because of money that ends up diverted to non-VA community health care. Your response to those concerns and how you balance that?
Excellent point, Larry. It's one of the most important strategic issues that we face as an agency. And just to amplify a moment, the months of March, April, and May of this year saw record levels of care in the community for our vets. So that reflects two things: the surge in need that we talked about a couple of minutes ago, but it also reflects an increased set of opportunities for our veterans to get care in the community if either because they live so far from a VA facility or because there's a extra wait time at the VA facility, they can get authorized to go get that care in the community. So we're seeing huge demand for that right now. So we as the VA are asking ourselves, how is it that we are making sure that we're managing those costs in the community, just as we have to manage costs in the VA system itself. And then we're also asking ourselves, how do we ensure that we're more competitive so that we keep our veterans in our care? So that means we have to continue to offer the full range of specialties that we offer. We have to continue to be the best caregiver for veterans, including by giving all sorts of post-deployment health care and drawing on our expertise there. But then we also have to make sure that we're getting care provided quickly in a timely way. And I think you're going to see really good news on that over the coming months, because we're making a lot of important reforms to ensure that our vets can get their care and get it in a timely way. And the last thing I'd say on this, Larry, is the good news about this challenge is that veterans overwhelmingly want to get their care at VA. And so we just have to make sure that we're implementing best practices in a way to make that easy.
Well, the challenge, though, is financial. The VA looking for a 27% boost in its budget for community care for fiscal year 22, and then another 24% increase from the current funding level for the subsequent fiscal year 2023. So, I mean, this comes with a very big price tag. I understand that often this is far more convenient for veterans than going to a VA facility, but how is that financially sustainable?
Well, remember that that's coming off of a lower baseline, and what we're also seeing, Larry, at the same time is a significant demand for care in the system. So that is to say, not in the community, but actually in VA. And we've seen over those same months that I just mentioned, March, April, and May of this year, we're seeing record requests for care in the direct care system. And we also know, as I said a minute ago, that vets far prefer the direct care system. So so you're absolutely right to raise this. We do have to get smarter about how we're managing those costs. But we also have to just get better about how we're providing care in the system so that we keep our vets in there. Is it a cost question over time? Absolutely. But I think with managing some of these reforms, we'll be in a position to ensure that we maintain this integrated healthcare system, national integrated healthcare system that is the VA, and we can do that while managing this increased cost of care in the community.
We're talking with the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, Dennis McDonough, joining us on Air Talk. As you know, of course, here in Southern California, particularly at the West LA VA, there have been deep concerns about homelessness among veterans there, and there have been a number of encampments on the perimeter of the VA grounds. There's an effort to try and use some of the surplus VA property in West Los Angeles for housing of people who've been without housing in Southern California. What is the VA's obligation to house homeless veterans, and what specifically in West LA is being done there to accommodate that?
Yeah, thanks so much, Larry. The veterans homelessness is a national problem, and we've made good progress in addressing that issue over the last decade. There's now half as many homeless vets in 2021 as there were in 2010. But that doesn't mean there's not significant problems remaining. And in fact, of the number of about 37,000 homeless vets currently in the country, about one in every three of those is in LA.
Wow.
If we're going to get this issue addressed, we're going to have to get it addressed right there in LA. So the president has set aside a significant increase of nearly $350 million additional over this year for next year in addressing homelessness. That includes things like significant funding for what we call supportive services for low-income vets. Those are some of the vets that we see in the situation in LA. We do things like providing care, treatment, and rehabilitative services for vets who qualify in LA and elsewhere. We've seen somewhere around a couple of hundred vets participate in that programming. That provides comprehensive services, not just housing, but the healthcare services, the mental health, substance abuse disorder services that are necessary to keep vets who are housed in their housing. And we'll see, frankly, I'll just be candid with you, Larry. I think this was not given the attention it should have been given over the course of the last 4 years at the national level. That's changing with President Biden and his budget request and with me and this building at VA. And it's changing with the significant investments that Mayor Garcetti is putting into homelessness in his budget this year. So I feel very confident that with this housing first agenda, increased resources, and focus on making sure that our vets get them.
Secretary McDonough, thank you for being with us today. We appreciate it very much. I leave you with Lucy in Pasadena, says kudos to the VA. My brother is a veteran, recently hospitalized, recovered under VA care, and the service was great. Lucy, thank you for sharing that. And Secretary McDonough, I hope we can talk with you again soon to talk about some additional important areas for veterans here in Southern California.
That'd be great. Thanks so much, Larry.
Thank you very much. That's Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, Dennis McDonough, with us on Air Talk. Coming right up, it's Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk, and I so appreciate your generous support of the coverage we give to so many topics like veterans issues with the Secretary of Veterans Affairs just joining us. And now we're so pleased to have from San Francisco, UCSF, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine, Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Dr. Chin Hong, very good Thursday morning to you.
Good morning, Larry. So great to be on. Thank you.
We start with some good news. Johnson & Johnson says the U.S. health officials have extended the expiration date for millions of doses of its COVID-19 vaccine. The extension is an extra 6 weeks. The drug maker says the FDA approved a longer shelf life for those one-dose shots. State officials had said that many unused doses would reach their original three-month expiration by the end of this month. So, Dr. Chin Hong, it sounds like very good news to get the six-week extension that the J&J vaccine would still be effective and usable.
It's huge news, Larry. It's huge news for two reasons. First of all, it is a great option for folks in the United States who wanted, for reasons of convenience and other reasons, to get one shot without having to come back for a second shot. But most importantly, I think freeing up more millions of vaccines will help the U.S. in its donation effort. And of course, they've been stepping up that donation effort. Now the Biden administration has pledged to donate 200 million doses to the rest of the world.
And the Johnson & Johnson would seem to be particularly good for that because it is a single dose, right? So areas of the world that are less developed, more rural, there could be big advantages of this over the mRNA vaccinations.
Exactly. The other reason why it's great for the rest of the world, as well as rural areas in America, is that, again, you don't need ultra cold temperatures to store it. It's much more forgiving in terms of the distribution chain.
All right. If you have questions for Dr. Peter Chin Hong, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Yesterday, members of the Cal OSHA Workplace Safety Board met again to look at what sorts of recommendations they'll be making, particularly for mask wearing on job sites. You might recall that last week there was a very contentious 9-hour meeting over what the rules would be starting June 15th, next Tuesday, when the state essentially opens up. And what it called for is a workplace that where not everybody is vaccinated, that everybody should continue to wear face coverings. Now the Workplace Safety Board at Cal OSHA is suggesting that fully vaccinated employees could go without wearing a mask in almost all work sites. Healthcare facilities, of course, not part of this. You'd still have to wear a mask on public transit. There are a few other places where it would still be required. Dr. Chin Hong, what do you think about the board's reversal and making this recommendation yesterday?
It leaves me with a sigh of relief, Larry, because I think it would have been very confusing for employees to live in two worlds. The world of the CDC guidelines, as well as the state guidelines, and then the world of the workplace. And to have alignment makes it less confusing. I think it makes it simple. Simpler is always better. And of course, we have to be flexible as a community so that if things change, we can modify. But again, starting off with one rule for everybody, I think makes a lot of sense to me.
So then for workplaces, it sounds like it's going to be an honor system, essentially, and they're just going to have to trust that their employees who are not fully vaccinated wear masks. You see any better system than going that route?
I think trust is going to be an issue. Trust is an issue not just for the workplace, but I think for the rest of us in the community as well. I think what I anticipate is that after June 15th, that not everybody will suddenly throw off their masks and put in a bonfire and sing around the bonfire. But rather, I think because of questions about trust in the beginning, people will probably keep on their masks, some folks, until they feel a little bit better about the circumstances.
All right. If you have questions for Dr. Peter Chin Hong, again, you can tweet them at AirTalk or post on the AirTalk Facebook page. The U.S. saw remarkable increases in the death rates for heart disease, diabetes, and some of the other major killers that over the course of the pandemic year. The question is, what's the reason for that? Was COVID-19 somehow directly a part of that? Or was this people staying away from the typical health maintenance care that they would have been getting had it not been a pandemic year? What do you think is most likely at work here, Dr. Chin Hong?
I think it's a little bit of both, but it's mainly people not going to the healthcare system for routine healthcare maintenance, even colonoscopies, pap smears, all of the things that we were worried about. I think from the statistics, they're holding true in terms of, about 8% death rate increase from Alzheimer's, even blood pressure's up, stroke deaths are up about 5%. But it's also interesting to think about a misclassification of COVID so that particularly in the early times, people weren't calling something COVID, lack of diagnostics, lack of wanting to blame systems. So they're calling it something else. So I think it's a little bit of both, but it's mainly people not getting healthcare maintenance.
Also, one of the things we've seen consistently with COVID-19 is the risk obesity displays for people who get COVID, and so often problems with their lungs that have resulted from that. Does this give healthcare providers some additional leverage to talk with patients about their weight, or what is there a potential positive out of you know, this terrible result for so many people who were obese and overweight who lost their lives to COVID?
Yes, I think it's certainly a starting point for a conversation that healthcare providers can have with patients. On the other hand, it's also a starting point for empathy, because I think it also illustrates that COVID and staying at home and the stress of COVID is one of the multiple ways in which obesity is informed by. It's not just a simple solution or formula of eating and exercising. It's really multifactorial, including stress, circumstance. Even though one can say, well, you're at home, you can have a better exercise program, but then again, it really illustrates how complex weight gain is in our society.
Again, we're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPECC. To join us, Cynthia in San Gabriel says, I had the Johnson & Johnson single-shot vaccination, but I only see the mRNA vaccines like Moderna or Pfizer's, you know, talking about the effectiveness. I don't ever see the stats on J&J. I feel like I got the wicked stepsister of shots. Cynthia asks, should I get a Pfizer or Moderna shot?
At this point, I think the answer is no, because even though there hasn't been a lot of data in terms of efficacy against variants, et cetera, recently, we do know that for all of the vaccines, regardless of what you have, you're going to be protected against the most serious consequence, which is, again, serious disease, hospitalizations, and death. So I think that is something to celebrate. And, you know, infection data is probably not as compelling to many of us in the healthcare system as, you know, preventing some of these most serious outcomes. So I think Cynthia right now should be rest assured. I think we may see further guidance about boosters perhaps in the future, but for right now, sit tight and feel good.
All right, Cynthia, thank you for your question. We'll continue with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center. He's professor of medicine at UCSF, infectious disease specialist, and we'll take your calls and your questions as we continue on this Thursday morning here on Air Talk.
Support comes from Japan House LA presenting Yes, Kawaii is Art. Express yourself. Kawaii translates to cute or adorable, yet its influence extends beyond aesthetics to encompass fashion, art, technology, and even social behavior. Sebastian Masuda, the king of kawaii, brings together multiple artworks unraveling the kawaii concepts to foster a sense of joy, innocence, and community as a tool for self-expression and representation. Visitors can step into this colorful world to feel the aesthetic for themselves. May 2nd to November 3rd. No admissions fee. More at japanhousela.com.
I was just thinking about Tom and Rita with their challenge. And of course, they went through COVID-19 and were sick very early on in the pandemic, and gave many of us a preview of how challenging it can be. Of course, you know, they came out, thankfully, the other side from it, but we have a sense of how serious COVID-19 could be very early on. Your questions for Dr. Peter Chin Hong, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Jose in Downey says, we're planning to have a Father's Day gathering in the backyard with 12 people, 8 vaccinated, 4 unvaccinated, and unwilling to wear masks. I wonder what Dr. Chin Hong thinks about it. Is it safe for the unvaccinated to congregate with the vaccinated outdoors?
That's a great question. I think right now in the outdoor setting, again, if the unvaccinated folks are unwilling to wear masks and they come from multiple households, there's a chance that they would be transmitting to each other. But given the low levels of disease in the community right now, particularly in Southern California, actually, it's the lowest number per 100,000 in all the regions in the state. The chance is small, but it's there. So I think the vaccinated folks won't have any problems with getting it. There's a small chance that the unvaccinated folks, if they come from multiple households, would. But again, given where we are in the community, it's going to be a small risk. But I would take that opportunity to have a conversation in a non-judgmental way about, you know, fueled by curiosity, why they didn't get vaccinated so far.
It's just, you know, so many of the people who've dug in their heels about this, Dr. Chenong, as you know, it really doesn't matter what you say to them. It's they've made their decision and they're not going to do it. And I'm sure you see this with your patients and your colleagues at UCSF see that kind of resistance as well.
Yes, definitely. I think the remaining folks who are unvaccinated, definitely a range of different reasons, have a range of different reasons, but it's definitely a hard nut to crack.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. San Francisco has one of the highest vaccination rates in the country, the city nearing a coronavirus herd immunity. L.A. is still said to have months to go, but I raised this yesterday and I want to raise it again. Johns Hopkins, Dr. Marty Makary, who writes on COVID-19 for The Wall Street Journal, has posited that what we have is much more immunity than is readily apparent because of the number of people who've been exposed to COVID-19 but were asymptomatic and weren't tested for it. So his argument is, we've got a significant percentage of people who've, unbeknownst to them, had COVID, coupled with those that have been vaccinated, bringing us essentially to herd immunity. And I wonder if that's why here in Los Angeles, Dr. Chenong, you are seeing such low rates of COVID-19 because we had that huge surge of people who got it here.
Exactly. You know, as we've talked about before, it's estimated that at least one in three folks probably in LA County has seen COVID naturally over the bad winter surge and before that. And when you look at the numbers, actually, it's striking because number of new cases for the last 7 days, Southern California, 13, Northern California, 50, Bay Area, 16. So vaccination rates don't tell the whole story, as you pointed out. You know, LA probably has a 55% vaccination rate now compared to other counties like San Francisco, where it's 80% in some areas. But again, the numbers speak for itself, and it reflects the combination of vaccines plus natural herd immunity.
Yeah, and so I guess why don't we talk about that when public health officials talk about herd immunity? They'll talk about the high rate of vaccination in San Francisco or Seattle, you know, versus other cities. When that's only part of the story, why don't they also look to what the previous rates of known COVID-19 exposure, and I don't know if there are models to try and get to the hidden amount of exposure as well, and include that when looking at herd immunity?
I think that's a great point, Larry, but I think it's really difficult to do because when you get COVID naturally, there's actually a big range in how your immune response or what your immune response is, up to 1,000 in some cases between individuals, whereas the vaccine immunity is very reliable and we know what it does from the studies. And we also don't know how long natural immunity would last, But yes, I think it is missing from a lot of the narrative. For me personally, just looking at the number of new cases in the last 7 days is probably a good indicator of what herd immunity is. And like I mentioned, it's looking pretty amazing right now in Southern California.
Dr. Peter Chenong, UC San Francisco Medical Center, joining us, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine at UCSF. Marty in Hollywood says, I'm wondering what's happening with coming up with modifications to the vaccines, boosters in the like. Will it be possible to have a future vaccine that could cover all the known variants?
Oh, that's a great question from Marty. So various companies are working furiously to devise different strategies? Do you put all of the different types and, you know, like passengers on a bus and develop a multivalent vaccine like we've done for other vaccines like influenza, and even the flu vaccine has four different types every year? Do you just give a booster to the scary variant that's particularly vaccine resistant, like the Indian Delta variant? Or do you try to make a universal vaccine that's not just only good for the current COVID, but good for any future variant? So these are all things that people are looking at, but it still remains a question when and who would get a booster. You could also think of populations. Maybe it may be in very older individuals, like say over 80, as we know how long immunity lasts over time. It may be in immunocompromised individuals that we may need boosters. So I think these are all unresolved questions. But for right now, we have, again, tens of thousands of folks who got a head start from us in the trials who are going to be continue to be followed to give us additional info as well.
President Biden just said in England, where he was meeting with Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the president said the group of seven nations is going to join the U.S. tomorrow in announcing global vaccine donations in an aim to end the pandemic. You might have seen the news earlier this week that the U.S. is buying, I think it was 100 million doses of vaccine that's going to be donated to the global effort. Dr. Chin-Ong, your thoughts about the president's announcement just moments ago?
I think it's great. It'll be limited by, the ability to get all of the doses, not just from storage, say in the United States, because we purchased more than a billion doses as part of Operation Warp Speed, with the idea that not everything will work. But turns out that everything is working pretty well, and we didn't even get any approval yet for Novavax, which has some really good data. So I think, 200 million doses donation from the U.S. Is going to, make a dent in the world and hopefully followed by other countries. But again, with the Indian pandemic going on now, it's going to limit the use of big generic companies to really scale this up. So I think it'll initially be a matter of supply. And then, of course, some people wonder if it's still going to go to the elite in the different countries.
Yeah. And let me just update. I way lowballed the purchase of vaccines. My apologies. It came out last night and I recalled the number incorrectly. It's 500 million doses of Pfizer's corona vaccine that the president announced last night will be contributed from the U.S., plus then the group of seven nations with their announcement tomorrow. Dr. Chin-Ong, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks so much.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. A key reservoir on the Colorado River has dipped to its record low. This in the latest showing of how the drought has affected the American Southwest and West. The surface elevation of Lake Mead along the Nevada-Arizona border dipped to 1,072 feet as of last night. That level was last hit in July of 2016. It's 19 feet lower than a year ago, and it's the lowest level since Lake Mead was filled in the 1930s. U.S. Bureau of Reclamation spokeswoman Patty Aaron says we're expecting the reservoir to keep declining until November, then it should start to rebound. And that, of course, a very, very serious concern. The Colorado River supplies 40 million people here in California, in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, not to mention a $5 billion a year agricultural industry. But the drought and its effect on Lake Mead is just one example of what we're seeing in reservoirs all across the western United States. Joining us to give us the snapshot of the broader impact of the drought is NPR correspondent covering climate change, Lauren Sommer. Lauren, good to have you with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Lake Mead, of course, we look at as a significant bellwether for the Colorado and for water supply, you know, much of what comes to Southern California through the Wholesaler Metropolitan Water District comes from the Colorado River. But what are we seeing in other parts of the American West?
Yeah, I mean, no matter where you look, the numbers really are not good. I mean, several southwestern states, you know, including California, if we look at the last 12 months, it's the driest on record since the record keeping began in 1895. So we see a lot of low reservoirs all throughout California, throughout the Southwest. And as the Southwest in particular, I mean, this is a 22-year drought that's been going on. So this is a long-term trend where we're really seeing a lot of concerning numbers, but ones that are not surprises.
Here in Southern California, it appears we're a little better off because we've got significant water storage that was built over the past couple of decades. But I know Northern California, things are really looking tight. Fill us in on what's going on. You're up in the San Francisco Bay Area. What are things looking like there?
Yeah, well, most of the state, you know, including Southern California, we relies heavily on the Sierra Nevada snowpack. And those numbers were extremely low this year. So as a result, we're seeing some really low reservoirs at the very beginning of the summer, which is a big concern. And I think the thing to highlight, you know, it's not just about how much rain or snow we get. Climate change is having a really clear impact on how much water we're seeing in reservoirs, because when it's hotter, there's just more evaporation. We're seeing more rain and snow disappear into the air instead of running off into our reservoirs. And we're also, those reservoirs are lower because the soils are drier in the mountains. So those soils require more rain. They soak up a lot more moisture before we get that runoff. So it's definitely tied to precipitation, but there's a clear climate signal. And that happens whether or not there's a drought. That's something that's just happening because of hotter temperatures.
We're talking with NPR reporter who covers climate change, Lauren Sommer, correspondent for NPR, talking about the extent of the drought and what it means for the water supply here in California. I know some parts of California in decades past have had water rationing because of how severe previous droughts have been. Governor Newsom has declared states of emergency in a number of counties so far. Are we looking like we could end up with some rationing this year?
We're certainly seeing a few parts of the state, a few water districts, you know, telling their customers, you need to start cutting back, right? No more washing your car in the driveway. You know, please water your lawn a little bit less. And so a lot of that so far is voluntary. But as the summer drags on, you know, we could certainly expect to see a lot of those calls for conservation again. We're already obviously seeing the impact in the Central Valley for farmers because their water deliveries have been cut by the state and federal water projects that they rely on. So farmers are definitely feeling it in terms of having to make decisions about where they're going to put their limited water supplies this year.
And the water shortage emergency hitting nearly 2 million Northern Californians is a part of the drought. What does that state of emergency mean? Does it mean more of those kinds of restrictions that you're talking about, or what else is involved?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, you know, in the last drought, we did see conservation calls at the state level. They also tend to start at the local level, right? Water districts looking at their situation and saying, what do we need to do locally? The state of emergency kind of allows the state to do other things like waive some water quality requirements. You know, obviously in California, no matter where you are in the state, you know, your water supply is tied to this one little piece called the Delta, the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta. And the water that flows through there travels hundreds of miles around the state. And so it allows the state to waive some water quality rules there. They don't have to keep the water quite as fresh. And, you know, there's a lot of pushback on that from conservation saying that that's going to hurt wildlife in the region.
Well, and under the emergency declaration, you can also, you know, they're calling for a 15% cut in water usage. But already many Californians have done a number of conservation measures. The low-hanging fruit, you know, in many cases has probably been achieved. When we're looking at a 15% cut from 2019 water usage levels, I mean, Lauren, could be a significant and difficult to achieve cut.
Yeah, I mean, that's the good news from the last drought, right? Which is some of the water savings that we called for in the last drought in California, they stuck because people made decisions that have been paying off for years, right? They maybe ripped out their lawn and put in more drought tolerant plants. They changed some fixtures in their house. That kind of locks in the water savings. So while we did see a little rebound in water use after the last drought, you know, it stayed lower than it had been before, you know, that 2012 to 2016 drought. But I think the thing to remember for people at home, the majority of water use is in your yard. So that's definitely a place to look for water conservation. And the majority of water use in California is agriculture. And so that's going to be another place to really look for water savings.
We're talking with NPR correspondent covering climate change, Lauren Sommer, joining us on Air Talk today. If you have questions for her, we're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also tweet at Air Talk or post your question on our Air Talk Facebook page. Lauren, as we look at, you know, California's nearly year-round fire season now too, this has to be a great cause for concern when you look at the drought and what its effect. Last year we had catastrophic deadly fires. In fact, we have for the past a couple of years here in California. What are the regional fire agencies predicting in the way of threat this year?
Yeah, I'm hugely concerned. I don't think we can say that enough. You know, soils are very dry. Vegetation is very dry. The conditions are already out there for extreme fires. So at this point, I mean, everyone has to cross their fingers and hope that the ignitions don't happen in the first place. And the vast majority of wildfires in California are started by people in the sense that it's, you know, accidents or power lines, you know, or campfires maybe that got left behind. And so what we really have to hope is that we don't get extreme fire weather and see a lot of ignitions, because when those things start, they really get out of control, as we've seen in previous years, right?
And last year, we saw a firefighter shortage. Just the amount of resources necessary to battle all those Northern California fires that we had last year, it just so taxed the system to have that many going at once. Heaven forbid that happens this summer. We'll just hope that that isn't what hits us here. Lauren, I appreciate you being with us very much. What should we look for from public agencies as sort of, you know, indicators coming up? We had the Lake Mead measurement last night, which is significant. Are there other sorts of milestones throughout the summer we should look for?
Yeah, I mean, what comes next on the Colorado River in particular is that it's later this year, they'll probably declare an official shortage, which means that some states have to start cutting back. So Arizona and Nevada are first in line to take cuts. It doesn't affect California yet, but the reservoir is going to keep dropping over the next 2 years. That's what federal officials are expecting. So it's not really going to get much better. And if it really keeps dropping precipitously, California will also be in line to take cuts. So this is not going to go away after one rainy winter. This is a long-term problem the West is facing.
Lauren, thank you so much for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area, NPR correspondent covering climate change, Lauren Sommer, with us on Air Talk. And of course, you'll hear our own KPCC coverage of the drought, of fire danger, and of water supply. That's right here on KPCC. And you can also read it at LAist.com. Coming up a little bit later this hour, it's our KPCC Backbone Session. We'll hear from two of our KPCC colleagues who'll tell you about their work.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Glad to have you with us. A new study published in the journal Cognition caught the attention of some of my KPCC colleagues, and I thought it would be fascinating to talk with the lead author of the study, which shows a correlation between the size of someone's pupil of their eye, and performance on cognitive tests designed to determine everything from working memory to cognitive ability. Joining me is PhD student in cognition and brain science at the Georgia Institute of Technology, lead author of this new study, Jason Sukahara. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm happy to be on here, and thank you for having me.
So I know there have been a number of different studies that have attempted to look at this issue. Those studies have been criticized over the years for the sample size and even the controls on the lighting in the room where it's taken place. Briefly describe the number of participants in the study and what you had them do to look at this correlation between pupil size and performance on cognitive tests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've actually done like a number of studies over the years, and our sample size, we always try to aim for a large sample size to make sure that what we're finding is real out there. And so our studies range anywhere from as many as 350 participants to 200 participants. So quite a large sample size for a psychology study.
All right. And what did you have them do, and how did you measure their pupil size as they did it?
Yeah, so it's actually very simple. Basically, what we do is the first thing they do when they come into our lab is we sit them down in front of a blank monitor. So they're not doing anything, not doing any task or anything like that. We sit them down from the monitor, and we have an eye tracker that uses cameras and infrared lights to measure the size of the pupil. And that period can last for anywhere from 30 seconds up to a few minutes in which we're having them sit in front of the monitor. And so we call that baseline pupil size because they're not really doing anything. And then after that, we then have them perform a large battery of various tests of cognitive ability that include people's ability to solve novel problems, to hold information in memory for a short period of time, and also the ability to control their attention.
All right. And these are all things that correspond to at least part of what we think of as intelligence?
Yeah, this is a good question. So intelligence is, very broad term used for multiple ways. And what we're interested in is something that's referred to as fluid intelligence, which is really your ability to solve novel problems, as well as your ability to kind of learn quickly and pick up new information and behaviors and whatnot.
So you found that the baseline pupil size when not engaged in these sorts of tasks showed that the larger the pupil size, the more accomplished the participants were on these tests?
Yes, that's correct.
And how consistent was that finding from person to person?
Yeah, so that's an important question here. So we do find a correlation here, and the correlation is not perfect, so there's a lot of noise and other things impacting the size of someone's pupil, including lighting conditions, which we controlled for in a recent publication, age, their arousal level, how awake they are, all these other factors influence your pupil size. But there is at least a moderate to small correlation between the size of someone's pupil and their cognitive ability.
What are some of the theories as to why that would be? What is it about the baseline size of someone's pupil that would correspond to their performance on these tests of fluid intelligence?
Yeah, so people like to make all sorts of things out of this finding. And for us, what we're really interested in is this question of why is this relationship here? And this is really what science is about, right? It's about asking these questions, these why questions. What it turns out that actually this pupil size can reveal quite a bit about what's going on in the brain. And so to understand this relationship, we need to have some understanding of what's going on in the brain when people aren't doing very much at all, like just staring at a blank monitor. And so scientists already know a pretty great deal about what is going on in the brain when it's not really doing much. And it turns out that it's actually not, the brain itself is not very idle. When you're just like staring at a blank monitor, it actually spends a great amount of energy to maintain a healthy organization of brain activity. And this healthy organization of brain activity is important because when we engage in challenging tasks and behaviors, like solving a novel problem, our brain works best when when it's working together, when distant brain regions are kind of all working together at the same time. And so, and to be able to do that, the brain spends a lot of energy to make sure that it's always kind of having this organization, and so that the brain can work together when we need to all of a sudden quickly engage in something. When we need to switch from kind of just our default baseline mode to then, okay, now I need to engage my attention and focus on this task. Having that healthy brain organization helps us to do that. And it turns out that the pupil size is related to this area in the brainstem called the locus coeruleus. And it's just a small cluster of neurons, but it produces this neurotransmitter called norepinephrine. And this whole locus coeruleus system is pretty widely distributed throughout the entire brain. So it's connected to a lot of brain regions. And it does a lot of functions, but one of them is maintaining this healthy organization of brain activity. And so just in short here, our hypothesis as to why we think this relationship between pupil size and intelligence is there, that people who have larger pupils at rest when they're not doing anything probably have a greater regulation of activity by the locus coeruleus system, which then benefits people's organization of their brain activity, and which then influences their ability to solve novel problems and to control their attention. That's kind of a mouthful, I know. But
yeah, no, that is fascinating. We're talking with Jason Sukahara, PhD student in cognition and brain science at Georgia Tech. He's lead author of the new study published in the journal Cognition, which looks at baseline pupil size of the eye and its relationship with people's ability to perform tests of fluid intelligence, of their cognition via testing. If you have questions for Mr. Sukahara, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. You can tweet at AirTalk or put your question on our AirTalk Facebook page. If I'm understanding correctly, this sort of resting position, the baseline pupil still showing the brain is heavily engaged and multiple parts of the brain are in this sort of active state, not idle, as you said, I would still think that there would be significant differences into, for lack of better terms, sort of the intellectual horsepower between brains, so that you could have someone whose brain is comparatively, you know, quite active, but the cognitive ability from that brain just is not as great. So how do you factor in those individual differences in brain power, so to speak, versus the activity level of the brain, if that makes sense?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, these are the type of questions that we're going to try to answer in future research, because a lot of this, you know, research has not been done to look at how pupil size is related to brain activity and whatnot. But one thing is that, yeah, so it's not just about, so activity is one important aspect of the brain, but it's also just how organized the brain is and how efficient it is. So sometimes people can have maybe less brain activity, but that's because their brain is more efficient. It doesn't have to work as hard to solve problems and to control their attention. And it can do that because it's more organized. When people have more disorganized brain activity, they might have to try harder and have more of that kind of, yeah, that power of brain activity in order to perform not even quite as well as people who are more organized.
Yeah, so I was thinking of someone, for example, with ADHD, who I don't know whether the organization might not be the same in the brain, but would perform mm-hmm. super strongly on these tests of fluid intelligence. So you're saying it would take more energy for the person with ADHD to do that?
Yeah, possibly. There's also, you know, some different types of cognitive abilities maybe kind of getting in the mix here as well. So, you know, we talk about intelligence as this ability to solve novel problems, but then there's also the aspect of the ability to control attention, which is something that our lab focuses on a lot, is developing measures to measure people's ability to control their attention, which is going to be related to things like ADHD and whatnot. And while even though attention control is highly related to fluid intelligence, they're not the same thing. So there's some differences there. And so it might be that some people are really able to solve novel problems really well, have high fluid intelligence, but maybe their attention ability is not as as great, right? And so there's some differences here. And so future research is really interesting to kind of start to tease apart some of those things, some different cognitive abilities and how they're related to brain activity.
Alan in Burbank says, so if you get your pupils dilated, will it make you smarter? I don't think so. Real quickly, can you explain, Jason, how this is baseline pupil size?
Yeah. So important thing to always remember in these studies that and a lot of studies, but when we're talking about a correlation, we're not necessarily talking about causal relationships here. And there might be some causal relationships here, and we don't know which direction those causal relationships go. I would be surprised if it was that pupil size leads to people to be more intelligent. It's probably the other way around. But again, our evidence is only correlational, so we can't think about how increasing pupil size might increase intelligence in that causal kind of way.
Jason Sugihara, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you. He's the lead author of this new study published in the journal Cognition. He's a PhD student in cognition brain science at Georgia Tech.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.
It's been a great highlight for me over these first 3 days of our June member drive to get to talk with our KPCC colleagues about the work that they do as part of the backbone of KPCC. These are essential employees that provide everything and what they do towards the service that is 89.3 KPCC and is LAist.com. It's been a great chance to hear from them, and I'm so pleased to have with us today our Director of Corporate Sponsorship. She works in our underwriting department, Veronica Lopez, and our senior producer for emerging platforms, Michael Cosentino. Thank you both very much for being with us. And Veronica, let me start with you to just talk a bit about what you do working with corporate sponsorship. What does that entail?
Thank you, Larry. It's such a pleasure to speak with you. What we do, so I've been in the corporate sponsorship department for about 13 years. And what we do is we build partnerships with businesses. We help organizations brand their company and get their message to our listeners and our readers through all of our platforms, on air, digital, and podcast. And I work with such an amazing team and colleagues. If I could just give them a shout out, Justin Riley, Kelly Cola, Lori Milam, Mary Marcus, Michelle Rosin, and our support, Roy Len, Tom Davis, and our department leader, Mary Holly. It's such a wonderful team. And usually in sales, we are in corporate sponsorship. In the commercial world, you would call it sales. But here in public radio, we call it underwriting corporate sponsorship because we see it slightly different. It's building relationships with businesses. And I know I could speak for my colleagues. We fundraise for an institution that we are truly passionate about. So our goal is to help these institutions get their message across. And our listeners are a hard to reach audience. Most of these listeners, we could only get, or businesses can only capture here on KPCC because they're so dedicated to us. And they're also great supporters of our corporate sponsors.
Veronica, sorry. Oh, go ahead and finish.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, over these many years that you've been doing this work, has the visibility of public radio and specifically KPCC grown so that these corporations have a much better sense of who the audience is and why they want to reach that audience?
Thank you for asking. A lot of our arts and arts organizations are fully aware of the power of public radio and specifically KPCC, the power KPCC has. But from time to time, we still have to explain and share what public, the power of public radio to a lot of new corporate sponsors. And one thing I will say, we always welcome new businesses to join in supporting KPCC through corporate sponsorship, because this revenue that we raise through corporate sponsorship, it helps support the spectacular work that you, Larry, you and your team do, our reporters and KPCC as a whole.
We're talking with Veronica Lopez, a longtime director of corporate sponsorship here at KPCC, and also Michael Cosentino with us, senior producer for Emerging Platforms. Michael, share with us what your job entails, please.
Sure, and thanks for having me on, Larry. So I'm on the digital product team led by the amazing Andy Cheatwood. And if you don't know what the product team does, we build the things that make up the KPCC and LAist digital universe. That means our mobile apps, our websites, podcasts. These are all the things that we design, build, and maintain in conjunction with all the folks who write the words and record the audio, marketing, etc. My job on this team is I make sure that all of our audio content that you hear on the radio or on LAist is available across as many digital platforms as possible. That means speakers like Alexa and Google and our mobile apps, podcast apps like Apple Podcasts and Spotify, wherever you download your favorite KPCC or LAist podcast. And then I also look at trends for new possibilities, like what are we doing in cars? What can we do on social media? So that's kind of my main job. And aside from that, I also obsessively track the performance of all of our on-demand programs, including AirTalk. And then I use that data to find out what's working and what's not and how we could make improvements to the online experience.
And do you see trends over time with where our audience is going in the use of different platforms, for example, smartphone apps versus online streaming versus terrestrial radio? Are you able to see clear trends there?
I am, yeah. You know, and the reason why I'm here is because, you know, digital, and that encompasses, you know, streaming and on demand and all that, you know, that is really taking a major it's a major part of our traffic now, and it, you know, we're developing content for streaming and audio platforms just as we are for broadcast. It's all part of, you know, it all fits under the kind of brand umbrella now.
And of course, as you mentioned earlier, the smart home speakers, which are becoming more and more common in the homes mm-hmm. of our listeners as well. Michael, what about the challenges of developing, you know, these highly customized sorts of, whether it's an app or some sort of an interface with one of these different platforms? How long can it take to do something like that?
Well, it takes it takes a lot of resources to build these products, and you know, they are technically challenging. And also, you know, for example, if we were going to build a skill for Alexa or Google Home, it would probably take us several weeks, I would say, to a couple of months to do that. But it also encompasses kind of user research that we want to do and find out, you know, if we want to build these products and if the users are going to actually want them. So that's a big part of product development as well.
We're talking with Michael Cosentino. He's senior producer for Emerging Platforms here at KPCC. Also with us, director of corporate sponsorship at KPCC, Veronica Lopez. Veronica, I just wanted to ask you about underwriting overall the spots that listeners hear on the air, because I know so many commercial broadcasters and public broadcasting entities saw a huge drop-off during the pandemic. What have we seen here in terms of the trend at KPCC?
Thank you for asking that, Larry. We actually experienced something very similar to other broadcasters in terms of the drop-off, especially when the pandemic first hit. I want to say our colleagues and our corporate sponsors were the first to be hit hard financially from that. And a lot of our campaigns did cancel. We saw that a lot, especially with our arts organizations. And we had numerous conversations with them where we knew their struggles and we felt their struggles. Because one of the things about building these corporate partnerships is that you sometimes become friends with the people that you work with. So it was very challenging, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, for all of us to see what everybody was experiencing and also experiencing that personally.
And so we're seeing that starting to come back now, it seems.
Yes. Yes, we're starting to see some trends coming back. Our arts organization, some of our friends are returning. LA Fail, as we know, will be coming back, and we know other arts organizations will be joining us again. And I think it will start picking up a little bit more in late September and maybe early in the fall.
All right.
See a change.
Thank you both so much. I so appreciate it. I learned so much from these KPCC Backbone conversations with our colleagues at KPCC. Veronica Lopez from our underwriting department, where she directs corporate sponsorship, and Michael Cosentino, senior producer for Emerging Platforms from our product development department. Thank you both very, very much. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Tomorrow we'll have more of our KPCC colleagues who are part of the Backbone Essential Services, not specifically in content, but without these folks who make up the backbone, there is no content to share here on KPCC.
Oscar Gomez had a mission as a Chicano student activist and radio DJ.
He was a voice of people, who didn't have a voice.
He was mass media before there was what we have today.
But what happened the night he died?
There needs to be an ending to this. There needs to be some rest. There needs to be some closure.
Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.